Well, supervision lies at the core of a firm's compliance program. So with us, we have NFA staff that will discuss AP supervision, order handling, trading activities, supervisory procedures, employee training, and much, much more. So with us, we have Gabriel and John, and I'm just going to hand it over to them to take it away.
Thank you, Matt. Everyone, welcome to today's session. My name is Jonathan Flanagan, and I'm an exam manager on NFA's investigation group.
Thanks, John. Good morning, everyone. My name is Gabe Pelucci. I'm a senior manager with NFA's regulatory department. I've been with NFA for about 15 years now. I'm currently assigned to a group that's conducting examinations of CPO, CTA, IB registrants. Prior to that, John and I both had, pretty extensive experience examining our non-traditional swap IBs who focus on execution-only brokerage services for institutional customers. So a lot of the topics we're going to be discussing today from a supervisory perspective, John and I have really in-depth knowledge of it. So we're looking forward to the discussion today. Just to kind of set the expectations for the next hour, John and I will spend the first 35 so minutes going through our prepared presentation, discussing a number of supervisory topics that Matt kind of outlined. After that, both Dale and mentioned that Mike Salfaro is going to be joining us for a discussion on his firm's supervisory activities and practices. Just to make sure that we don't eat into Mike's time and we have enough time to go through our discussion, John and I may have to limit questions throughout our presentation. Anything unanswered, we'll certainly get to after in the networking breaks, but we'll stop periodically for questions. But we're definitely just going to keep an eye on the time so we can get to Mike's discussion. Yeah, great. So the overall goal of this panel is to discuss NFA minimum requirements, industry standards, and best practices. If implemented, will allow our member firms to create and implement an adequate supervisory framework, based on your risk profile, based on your operations, based on your activities. So with that being said, as a reminder, NFA compliance rules place the responsibility on each of its members' firms to diligently supervise its employees and agents in all aspects of their commodity interest activities, including swaps activities, for or on behalf of the member. So just there's a quick reference in there, including swaps activities. Full disclosure, John and I have little to zero experience on swap dealer examinations. If there's a question specific to swap dealers or swap dealer rules, if you're here tomorrow for a workshop, perfect place for it. If not, we have some capable people here, specifically Dale. He's volunteered to answer any swap dealer questions. Katie's here as well. So we definitely have some knowledge in the room. So just generally, I do feel this is an important discussion to have. As you can imagine, NFA has thousands of members. It's really not realistic. It's not feasible for us to be examining all of our members on an annual basis, with the exception of some of the registration categories John discussed prior that are on a routine exam schedule. So it's really important for us to educate our members, their consultants, their personnel, to a certain extent, to be able to self-regulate themselves in between NFA examination periods. And that all starts with education, right? Forums like this, our webinars, our, self-exam questionnaires, all of those resources available for you. We really want you to use those. That way you can implement a supervisory framework to, again, potentially identify areas of non-compliance on your own during the brief intersession of examinations. Okay, so John's going to start talking through the supervisory procedure requirements.
All right, thanks, Gabe. And where does it start? It starts with your procedures. A strong supervisory framework begins with your procedures, and your procedures should be designed to ensure that the firm is abiding by NFA rules and CFTC regulations. In addition to that, you should be really looking for instances of non-compliant activity. And now, what's the best practice to make sure your procedures are as detailed as possible? You're going to want to include things such as the frequency of reviews, You're also going to want to include maybe the scope of the supervisory function being performed, what documents you might be maintaining, and as well as how will you escalate, how will you investigate and bubble up potential issues so they can be investigated further. Now, there is no one-size-fits-all for a firm's procedures. Every firm's operations are different. And being that every firm's operations are different, everyone's procedures should also be different. And they should really be tailored to the risks associated with your firm. If they're not tailored to the risks associated to your firm, then you're going to leave your firm susceptible of not being compliant. And even worse, potentially not even being able to identify non-compliant activity. So very important that they're tailored to your firm. Also, you want to make sure that you're regularly reviewing your procedures. There's always changes. Your operations might evolve. The regulations might evolve. And with that, your procedures must also evolve. They must evolve to the different changes that are going on. Maybe you have a new business line. Maybe there's a new trading desk. Maybe there's employees working from a different location. These are all different changes that could impact and probably will impact your procedures. Also, we understand that third parties are playing a greater and greater role in the supervisory functions of the firm. If you are using a third party, just make sure that you are onboarding them and monitoring them in accordance with the firm's procedures as well.
I think we jumped a little bit ahead slide-wise, but
sorry,
we'll figure that out. So next, we wanted to talk about some topics related to the individuals that you're going to be hiring to perform these supervisory activities on your behalf, and also individuals that are going to be engaging in AP activities on your behalf. So just a few things to consider. First, you want to define areas of supervision and identify by title or position the person or persons responsible for performing each supervisory function. So I think this is very important for everyone internally to understand their role and responsibility. You don't want there to be any gray area as far as who is responsible for what area coverage. You never want to get to the point where, you know, a regulator comes in and says, okay, you know, recreate this process for me or recreate this review. And then, you know, you have two people looking at each other, kind of pointing at one another and say, I thought you were responsible for that, not me. So again, it's really important to identify, designate all of the roles and responsibilities within that supervisory chain of command. You also want to ensure that supervisory personnel are appropriately qualified. You know, the first thing you all should consider is you never want to set someone up for failure. You know, you want to make sure that the individual that you're onboarding, you're hiring, transferring into a role that has a supervisory responsibility, has the technical skill set, has the ability, has the education, has the background to perform that supervisory role at a high level. Again, you really don't want to have somebody that's going to put you at risk because they don't have the skill set or experience to perform that role that you're looking for them to do. Okay, so we wanted to talk about a few things to consider prior to onboarding any individuals in that supervisory capacity or those individuals that are going to be engaging in AP activity on your behalf. So again, here are a few things to consider. You know, I looking through this, reading through this, being on exams at your firms, talking to all of you, you're doing a lot of this. Great, right? So these are just reminders, best practices that we do expect you to be performing before you are bringing somebody into your organization. The first one is background checks. You know, really simple, trying to get an understand if there's anything in their background that could potentially be a red flag that needs to be addressed, investigated. The time to do that is during that pre-hiring due diligence. If you bring them on board and a red flag arises, it's too late, right? You want to be able to capture that before you get them within your organization. You want to confirm educational and employment information. So this kind of goes back to what I was talking about before, hiring qualified people. You want to really dig into their CV, understand what their experience was, understand what their education is. and make that determination. Hey, am I going to be comfortable if this person steps into this role? And is he or she going to be able to perform at a high level? Pending and or prior disciplinary matters. So not just NFA, CFTC, you know, matters, looking into any other regulators that person might have been regulated by in the past, you know, for SEC, FINRA, foreign regulators. So really understanding if they've been named in any matters. And I think an important point here is also to make is not just looking at the person's personal disciplinary matter history, if they were specifically named, but take a look at the firms they were working at. You know, if those firms were named in matters, you know, that could really lead to some questions needing to be asked. It can question the training they received. You know, a firm they were working at was historically routinely disciplined by their regulators. You know, they could have been exposed to a pretty material culture of noncompliance, which could have impacted their development in the industry, their kind of expertise and experience. So again, not just looking at it at a personal level, but also at the member firms that they were working at. Member firms should also require APs to notify employer of any new disciplinary, criminal, and other matters that may require disclosure. So if you do bring somebody on board that, you know, had a clean background, you know, no red flags, no disciplinary history, great. However, you know, we know things happen. Things come up. If someone is working for you and unfortunately has a matter that should be disclosed to you, you should have a forum, an avenue for them to have an ability to disclose that to you. A best practice that we could recommend is having attestations periodically completed, quarterly, semi-annually, annually, just to allow them the ability to say, okay, I didn't have this when I was onboarded. However, it's an issue now and I want to disclose it to my employer. They have the opportunity and forum to do that. Yeah.
All right, great. So thought it'd be best to start with a transition to a couple of the CFTC regulations that we wanted to discuss, and that's regulation 131 and 135. And they require members to keep full, complete, and systematic records of all transactions. And that would include things such as orders, journals, ledgers, confirmations, things of that nature. And you're required to keep those for a period of 5 years. In addition to that, our FCMs and our introducing brokers are required to keep all communications that lead up to a trade. And that would include all quotes, bids, offers, solicitations, instructions, anything. Really anything, any electronic communications that led to that trade must be captured, must be retained. It doesn't matter if it was a broker talking to a customer. It doesn't matter if it was a broker talking to another broker. Internal only conversations that lead to the execution of a trade must also be captured. And now written communications have to be maintained for a period of 5 years, whereas oral communications, they need to be maintained for a period of 1 year. Now there is a small carve out for some of our smaller introducing brokers. If you generated less than $5 million over the last 3 years, then you would fall into this category. Oral communications would not be required to be recorded or maintained. However, you still are required to maintain the written communications in that scenario.
Okay. Before we move on, I think that might be a good point to kind of take a pause, see if there's any questions. Can we just wait for the microphone?
Hi, can you just repeat that again? If you're an introducing broker and you generate less than $5 million, how long do you have to keep your records?
So it's on a rolling basis. So if you generate less than $5 million over 3 years, then you don't need to record or maintain the oral communications, but the written communications are still required.
And that's subject to the 5 year?
It's three. It's $5 million over 3 years, but it's a rolling basis.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
When it comes to examinations and books and records, how much can you give like an estimate of like the time period that you would request any trade information, trade blotter details, and how quickly the turnaround would be to provide that information?
I mean, there is going to be exceptions. I would say generally we're looking back the last few months, but as you can imagine, we're going to be chasing the risks. So if there's reason for us that we need to get records a few years out, then we could be requesting those as well. I want to say it doesn't happen a ton, but it does happen. I was just on a couple of firms where I requested records for a couple of years. So generally speaking, it's just the last few months, but it could be a longer period of time than that.
So say, for instance, you wanted the last few months. So would you request like maybe the last 3 months of trade records?
Yeah, I would say like generally speaking, it's like the last 3-4 months. But again, if there's a reason for us to believe that there's a potential non-compliant activity in a different period of time, we could potentially review that as well. But yeah, generally 3-4 months.
And how quickly would you expect the turnaround time? Is it the typical 2 to 3 days that was previously mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, if it's under 2 years, you know, we deem that readily accessible and that should have a very quick turnaround time. Mm-hmm. You know, we are flexible. I think the last panel said they, you know, we try to be flexible. So if you need a couple more days, especially if you're looking at something that's a longer period of time out, then it would probably be okay as long as you communicate it.
Hi, this might be a bit of a broader question, but maybe specifically to the review of policies and procedures. To what level are you using AI to maybe review the requirements of the procedures? And, you know, how is it affecting the exam process? Is it expediting it? Like, how are you using it?
I would say not at all at this point. AI really does not have an impact in our exam process or a place in our exam process right now. You know, as far as what the future holds, stay tuned.
During the exam, in the preliminary questionnaire, I've been given conflicting advice sometimes about whether to answer yes, no, NA, explain it. In communication from the NFA, I've seen NAs deserve an explanation. And then I've been told that we should just never give any more information away that's necessary, which is kind of counterintuitive to my thoughts. But how do you appreciate NFA exam responses? Do you appreciate yes, no, NA, or would you like explanations for each answer?
I mean, I think that might be based on the team itself. From my perspective, I generally maybe would like a little bit more just because I want to make sure you understand the question properly. And maybe I've seen it so many times where a firm write a question, and they thought that they were answering it correctly. Then as we're going on, we have a communication and it wasn't what we were expecting. So from my perspective, I would say if you give a little bit more, and then if it's obvious later on, you could probably just refer it or something like that.
Okay, I think we're going to move on just for the sake of time. And like I said, any questions that we don't get to, we'll certainly do afterwards. So the next area that we wanted to dig a little deeper in or on is the firm's communication monitoring program. So where we wanted to start with this is going through, you know, what your policies and procedures should entail to oversee your communication monitoring program. You know, the most obvious, they should be in writing, right? So everything, once it's agreed upon, you know, what level of supervision is going to be needed to oversee based on your risk profile and your activities, they should be defined in writing and shared within your organization so everyone is on the same page. So the first area that we would like to see is that these policies and procedures should identify the improved methods of communication. So this is extremely important that everyone is on the same page. Your employees, your APs who are communicating with customers understand what communication platforms are allowed and what are prohibited. So a perfect example of this is personal cell phone usage. If it's either issued device by the firm or just using their own, it's really important for them to understand if that's permitted or not, right? Because this obviously leads to record keeping issues when, you know, if an employee is using a platform that he thought was approved, but it's not, it's obviously probably not being ingested into surveillance systems, record retention systems. So it can definitely lead to major problems down the road. So next, we want to identify how communications are recorded and retained. So you want to make sure that it's clear and obvious how these communication platforms are being recorded, what software is being used, and then how it's retained and backed up. And then you want to identify the person or persons responsible for conducting reviews of the activity. So again, going back to that, you know, clear delineation of responsibilities, identifying who is going to be performing your reviews of your communications, both written and oral. Okay, so continuing on with the written procedures. So you want to specify how and with what frequency the activity will be reviewed. I think John kind of touched on this before. You know, obviously, it's not one size fits all. You know, we do understand the frequency is going to change from member to member based on risk profile, based on activities. So again, whatever is determined is appropriate for your operations and senior management has signed off, that should be documented within your written procedures, whether it's monthly, quarterly, annually, it should be defined so everyone is on the same page who's performing that review. You want to describe how the reviews will be documented. So if you're using Excel spreadsheet-based, you know, record retention, if you're using Google Docs, it should really be defined on how you're going to document what review took place. And then you want to describe how records of the review will be maintained. So again, if you're using some sort of SharePoint drive where, you know, everyone has access to it, everyone can go in there and, you know, it creates transparency. It allows people to, you know, understand what's going on from a supervisory perspective. Again, that should be outlined. So everyone that knows or is involved in the process, they know where to go and get that information. And from a regulatory perspective, when we come in, you know, we're going to be requesting these documentation in support of these reviews. Your personnel are going to know where to obtain them from.
I just wanted to continue along with some of the elements of an effective program. And the next up is training. Obviously, very, very important element to the program. But I'm going to delve a little bit more into that later on into the session. But also having defined investigation, escalation, and remediation process outlined within your program is definitely a good idea. Your first and second line of defense will appreciate it. If there is a potential issue that they do uncover, they should know how to bubble up the potential issue, what they should be looking at, what they should be maintaining, and what a remediation plan might look like given the specific scenario. Also, having a defined disciplinary framework is always another really good idea, and it helps keep your employees informed of what the consequences could look like. With that note, having code of conduct attestations, another good idea. I would say best practice is do it initially when they're onboarded, once they first join the company, and then do it periodically thereafter. I don't know if for your firm, if that means annually or even more frequent than that. But that would be something for you to decide. And I would strongly suggest you do it in writing just to help create a little bit more accountability. So I think that's always the best practice as well. The next item is to continuously reevaluate your program. And I kind of hit that on before. There's always changes to operations, regulations. Continuously reevaluate your program just to make sure that you're addressing, that addresses all the different risks. So that really is one of the most important elements to an effective program. So just keep looking at it. Next off is comprehensive reviews. You want to make sure that reviews are risk-based and tailored to the firm's operations. You want to make sure that they're reasonably designed to detect instances of non-compliant activity. We're not looking for a completeness check here. We're looking for a real review, a review to try to actively seek out non-compliant activity. And at least in my opinion, as a good reminder, is finding non-compliant activity is not necessarily means it's a bad procedure. The exact opposite could be true, especially if you find it fast enough, it could be the sign of a great procedure at work. So actively seek out the non-compliant activity that might be at your firm. And then also make sure that reviews are all-encompassing. You want to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. You're not missing anything. Low risk doesn't mean no risk. So just because something's low risk, yeah, you might review it a little bit less frequent, but you cannot ignore that risk either. next up is automated methods of detection. I think we can generally all agree that automated methods of detection are typically better than manual reviews. One of the ones that we come across all the time are the use of lexicon lists. And lexicon lists are a great way to detect non-compliant activity. It's the use of keywords and phrases that are really supposed to target that activity based on the risks that your firm is prone to. And being that they're targeting your firm, this you should also make sure that you regularly review. NFA, on our exams, we use lexicon lists all the time. We actually have a team that's one of their responsibilities is to keep reviewing that list just to make sure that it's up to date and our exam teams are working with the most current risks to identify non-compliant activity. And then with these lists, if you have brokers that are speaking in foreign languages, you're probably going to have to update that list to account for that as well. That way you can, that way, if you're running them through written communications, those will be picked up as well. And some of our members have the ability to transcribe oral communications. You could then also run that lexicon list through those oral transcript, those transcripts as well. And then lastly, when it comes to supervision, everything comes down to documentation. We know, you know, as examiners, we do reviews. We know there's a lot of work, time, and effort that goes into those reviews. Make sure that the documentation is reflective of your review. We should be able to see everything that you did, everything that you considered when you're providing us the documentation. You know, who conducted the review? What was reviewed? You know, what was the results of the review? Did the firm have to do anything in response if there was something found to be deficient?
All right, great. In addition to the communication monitoring program that we just spent some time on, another integral part of your supervisory framework is going to be reviewing order handling and trading activities. So the elements of an effective program ensure that supervisory measures are in place to review and monitor its AP's order handling and trading activities to identify potential trading misconduct and market abuses. So these measures should oversee an AP's trading activities on behalf of customers, but it also should oversee the trading activities of in a proprietary nature. So if you do have employees and you allow employees to trade on their own behalf, or if the member firm is trading proprietarily in their own name, this program should oversee that as well, right? So, you know, that I do feel that is sometimes overlooked, right? Because obviously the focus is on the customers typically. So that is the main point of your supervisory framework, is to ensure customers are being treated fairly in a non-preferential manner. But you also want to make sure that any employee trading is consistent as well and in compliance with rules and regulations. Okay, so we wanted to talk about what an effective program looks like. So first, you want to outline the frequency and scope of the review. So we've touched on this already. So anything that's decided upon by senior management as far as frequency and scope, it should be documented. It should be clearly defined what the expectation is. That way that person is in the know of what they're responsible for. And then it also allows, if somebody needs to step in that role, they can quickly read that policy and procedure and then recreate that review. John touched on this, the manner in which reviews are going to be conducted, whether it be automated or manual. Again, you know, automation is great, you know, at least at a minimum, if you have an automated system that's able to generate first line of defense alerts. And then, you know, those alerts can be raised to more of a manual review, investigation, and clearing. That's great as well. You also want to make sure that you have documentation of the review and any investigation that took place. So really important to make sure that, you know, you're able to document what took place. If we come in and conduct an exam, we're able to get that support and be confident that the policy and procedure that you implemented was performed. You want to have an escalation process, right? So any issues that are identified, You want to have a clear escalation process on how that's going to be identified, investigated, and remediated. This goes back to the qualifications in hiring as well. It's really important to have somebody who's familiar with trading within that escalation process so they can really make a determination if what they're seeing is reasonable or not, and they're just not relying on the representation of the trader or broker, right? So really having that knowledge base within that escalation process is key. You also want to evaluate the effectiveness of supervisory measures. So really making sure what's in place today is still appropriate, right? Because obviously there's material changes that go through your business all the time. So what you had in place last year might not be robust enough today, right? So really just taking that step back, self-assessing and understanding if any changes need to be made. You know, this could happen because, you know, maybe your firm went through an acquisition and you acquired a new trading desk that trades new products that you never had in your business line before. So that's going to be needed to be updated. You know, you could hire 10 new APs, right? So again, that's all needs to be evaluated. Take that step back, self-assess, and see if any updates are needed. And you want to just check to ensure that reviews are operating as intended. You know, when the policy and procedure control was implemented, you know, you had a goal for that, right? And just to make sure that it's functioning as intended, it's like John said, it's reasonably designed to find non-compliance, right? You don't want to have a control in place that's just to check the box, you know, and move on, right? You really want to make sure that it has a chance to uncover non-compliant activity. So we just wanted to quickly run through some things that you should consider when implementing your supervisory framework around this activity. This is not an exhaustive list. So, you know, obviously these are just, you know, areas that we want you to focus on, but I'm sure you're doing additional to this. So you should be reviewing error accounts, suspense accounts, and give up accounts. So, you know, for example, error account reviews should be conducted periodically to make sure that activity in that error account is really associated with errors, right? You don't want trades being placed into those error accounts that were not errors. You know, obviously errors are going to happen, but you should have the ability to review that activity to get to a comfort level that that activity is in accordance with your policies and procedures. You want to monitor post-trade activities. A couple examples of this are bunched order allocations, position transfers. You know, again, you want to make sure for example, bunched order allocations. If you're a firm that, you know, has decided that you're going to implement average pricing for split fills, you should be conducting periodic reviews to make sure that methodology is being implemented for all split fills on bunched orders. You know, you don't want to go in there and recreate a bunched order and you see, you know, a high-low methodology was implemented because that's not what you agreed upon and that's not what your systems are set up to do. So again, really making sure what activity you agreed on is taking place. And you want to review trade discrepancies and trade data. You know, really what you're looking for here is anomalies, kind of outliers, right? You know, obviously there are going to be discrepancies. There are going to be trade breaks. But again, having the ability to investigate them, to remediate them, and to gain an understanding if they were not caused by some underlying issue that needs to be remediated. So again, just having the ability to take a look at that data and investigating any outliers. Okay, some other things to consider is monitoring customer risk and position limits. Again, these are usually agreed upon on onboarding. You know, everyone should be aware of these limits. You don't want to have the situation where an AP or a broker went in and arbitrarily changed the position limit and now put your firm at risk, right? So you want to be actively monitoring these to make sure that they're in line with the customer's risk profile, risk appetite, and they're appropriate for that customer. You want to have the ability to review complaints from customers and counterparties. You know, this really gives you insight into any issues that, you know, you may not have been aware of. You know, us as a regulator, we receive customer complaints all the time, and, you know, they allow us to perform, you know, targeted investigations. So you really have to have a process in place to be able to receive these customer complaints, thoroughly investigate them, and then make that disposition if further action is needed or not. You want to, I kind of touched on this, you want to review firm and AP discretionary trading activity. You want to make sure that, you know, decisions being made by your APs or firm on behalf of their customers is in line with the expectations of that customer, and, you know, they're being treated fairly and treated fairly as far as what they agreed upon. And you want to review significant losses, changes in commissions, and large volumes of trades. Again, here, looking for outliers. You know, obviously, you know, the trading industry, you're always going to have significant losses. But again, you want to make sure if something looks a little off, you have the ability to investigate. Commissions. If you have a broker that's continuously waiving commissions for a certain customer, you know, you have to be able to question that, right? You have to understand, why would my broker not charge this customer commission? So again, it could kind of lead you to an, it could be certainly reasonable, right? But I think you need to investigate to be able to see, why is this decision being made?
All right, thanks. Trade reconstructions. So trade reconstructions are really a great way to identify non-compliant activity, which is really why they're a part of so many of our exams. To me, it's really one of the best ways to make sure that your brokers are using only approved mediums of communication. But not only that, it allows you to get further insight into how trades are being consummated and really how they're interacting with their customers. So definitely a great tool. And when looking at, when doing a trade reconstruction, you should really look at when the interest was initially expressed. Look at all the bids and offers across all the different counterparties, all the way up until the trade is executed. And if you could really map out that whole trade and there's no gaps, you'll have the confidence that your brokers really only used approved mediums of communication. Now, like I said, it's not the only benefit. You'll also get insight into how they're interacting with their customers. What information are they telling them? Are they disclosing anything that they shouldn't be, any non-public information? Are they only sharing bids and offers that are coming from other counterparties? So it's a great tool. There's a lot of benefits to it. It's definitely one of the better tools to put in your compliance toolbox. But trade reconstructions themselves are really only as good as your sample. And I don't want to tell you how many to do, but there's a lot of different factors that you should be able to look at to figure that out. You might want to weigh how many brokers you have or how many trading desks you have. And like what we were saying before, you want to actively seek out non-compliant activity. And how do you do that? By selecting the riskiest trades possible. You shouldn't be just throwing darts at a dartboard and maybe stumbling upon something that's non-compliant. Give it some thought. What are my riskiest trades? Maybe it's the broker that's underperforming that month. You know, maybe it's the trade that generated the most amount of revenue. Maybe there's some sort of market event that occurred that caused a huge spike in volatility and brokers took shortcuts. Just give it a little bit of thought. What are the riskiest trades? Those are the ones you should be reconstructing. And then, like we've been discussing, one of the themes of supervision is documentation. We know that there's a lot of work and time and effort that goes into the trade reconstructions themselves. We do them on our exams. You want to make sure that your documentation reflects your review. Don't just do a simple sign-off. Include some of the basic things, you know, who was involved in the review, what trades were selected, maybe why the trade was selected, what brokers were involved, you know, were there any issues? If there were issues, did you have to do anything in response, you know, maybe additional trainings or whatever the case may be? So just make sure that your documentation fully reflects everything that occurred with that trade reconstruction. And then I said I was going to hit upon trading earlier, and we did want to. It's very important that your employees are trained, you know. Definitely when they first enter the door, make sure they get trained, you know, and then periodically thereafter, depending on the risks associated with it. NFA does mandate certain things to be trained on, whether it's AML, cyber, ethics. But in reality, you should really be training your employees on anything that's a risk associated with the firm. You know, maybe you do have a broker or a group of brokers that use an unapproved medium of communication. That might be something you want to train them on. Oh, like NFA. NFA, we do phishing emails from our IS department. And sure enough, if I click on a link, I'm going to get a call up saying I have to do some cybersecurity training. Thankfully, that's never happened. But just look internally. Where are your risks? What risks are at your firm, and how can I train my employees to reduce that risk? That's what you should be training your employees on as well. And then once again, it all comes back to documentation. What did the training entail? Who received the training? And when was it taken? Basic documentation. All right, now I'm going to kick it back to Gabe, where we'll discuss on common exam findings.
Yeah, I think some of these we already discussed in the previous panels, just so for the sake of time, I think we'll kind of skip this. But again, you know, just really making sure that you have a process in place, you're documenting all reviews that are taking place, you have an escalation process. Those are really the key takeaways here.